failure to see the absolute distinctiveness of false apostleship lay at the root of their many doctrinal differences.
You have there a summary, basically, a summary of what he perceives to be the issues. Now, I want to make a couple comments. You should remember, hopefully, that Our Hope was a periodical that was edited and run by Arnold Gabelein. Okay? It, at this point in history, it had changed editorship, and we'll say more about that in a little bit. But they're reviewing this, and Stam responds to it with this article in the Searchlight in 1955. And he says, basically, now it's interesting, if you look at this quote, he views himself, it's important that you understand how Stam views himself. Stam views himself as the rightful heir, look at his terminology. The fact is that we are the heirs of the Schofield-Darby movement. So he views himself and those that agree with him as the rightful successors of the stream of thought that started with Darby and was popularized through Schofield in the Reference Bible. And he says that some of these men, of which Gabelein is one of them, that they were responsible for causing him to see dispensationalism as a system of interpretation. But that he also recognized that because they didn't go far enough in recognizing distinctiveness of Pauline authority, that was explaining why they had differences despite their dispensationalism. So that's happening in 1955. In 1956, Stam publishes Moses and Paul. Also in 1956, June 1st, Pastor O'Hare addresses a letter to his radio audience thanking them for 32 years of radio ministry. The station was completed July 17, 1924. That would be the station in the old church, so that's when the broadcast started. The letter states that O'Hare had published, at this point he reckons, 155 books, three of which, he says, are currently on the press. Now, I have a copy of that letter. That's this letter right here, addressed to Radio Friends, and it has it talks about the history of the radio broadcast here. It talks about the what their call letters are, so on and so forth. And then on the back, it includes a picture of him from his birth, right before his birthday, on his birthday, on December 31st, 1955. So he sends this out in June. In anticipation of the anniversary of the radio broadcast. He sends that out in June of 56. Now, if you look at the next point, July 14, O'Hare falls deathly ill and is rushed to the hospital. Now, you learn that in this, he puts this out in 1957. A thank you letter, and this is dated July 1957, and it's addressed to dear North Shore Church friends here and abroad, and radio friends. So what happens is this. So I'm on this point here. So he gets sick July 14, 1956, and it says sometime during the first half of 1956, O'Hare published the Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptists. This is clearly established by the following statement on page 2. One informed Christian in the year 1956 does not agree with most of these statements. Now I have a copy of that. That's this book right here. And he says on page 2 at the bottom of the page, exactly what I have there in the notes, one informed Christian in the year 1956. So this dates from 1956, okay? In this letter, he says that he has three books on the press that I just made reference to in the previous point, okay? Probably, I'm assuming, it's one of these. Now let me just finish my point here. The Grace History Project believes that this book right here, the Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptists, I believe that this was quite possibly O'Hare's last booklet. Okay, and I'll tell you why I think that. In the back on page 30, O'Hare declares that he has just sent to the printer a manuscript for a new book, which he believed to be the most important book of his career. Can somebody give me a tissue, please? I have just got a runny nose and it won't stop. Excuse me. Anyway, O'Hare believed this to be the most important book of his career. The title for this upcoming release was given as, this is a very long-winded title, How many of the more than 250 commandments, doctrines, ordinances, and religious ceremonies in the Bible does God want present-day Christians to obey, observe, and practice? So I'll show you that. Page 30. It's this section down here where he's announcing another new book. And this section here in the large, all capital type is what he says the title of the book is going to be. Okay? So, the facts are this. This book clearly was written in 56, and he's announcing another book that he sent to the printer. So back to the notes. There is no record that that book was ever printed. So what I am suggesting to you is that O'Hare must have fallen ill shortly after the Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptists was published. Okay? There is no record. Nobody has any record. I looked online. I called the library at GBC. I called the Berean Bible Society, the Berean Bible Institute, asked them if they knew of this book. Nobody is aware that this book was ever printed or published. This book with the long title about the more than 250 commandments, doctrines, and ordinances. Okay? Since this is clearly dated from 56, and since there is no record that the book that he says is going to be his next book was ever printed, I believe that the Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptists is quite possibly the last book that he wrote. Okay? Now, let me explain to you more why I think that, moving on into the next point. So, in 1957, in July of 1957, O'Hare writes a thank you letter that I just showed you, addressed to North Shore church friends here scattered abroad and radio friends. In this letter, we learned that O'Hare had fallen deathly ill shortly after his 55th wedding anniversary, which would have been July 11, 1956. The illness, operation, and recovery had incapacitated O'Hare for the better part of a year. So that would have been July 56 through July 57. Regarding this trying time, O'Hare wrote on the top of page 3, quoting from the letter, 3 days after Mrs. O'Hare and I celebrated our 55th wedding anniversary, I became very ill suddenly, quite seriously ill. I was rushed in an ambulance to the hospital in St. Charles. Later I was taken to the hospital in Elgin for an operation. Then I spent many weeks in the home of Dr. Weingarten and our daughter, his wife, at Wheaton. While at the hospital and during my weeks at Wheaton, I received hundreds of get-well cards and letters from Christian friends. Inasmuch as I, now notice what he says, inasmuch as I have been, as I have by no means fully recovered. So when he's writing the letter, he still says he's not what? He's not well. Okay? And have not been able to take care of my daily office work at North Shore, and have been quite weak and frequently in pain many days during the past year, several hundred unanswered letters have accumulated. I decided that the task of writing to each friend separately, which I would with pleasure like to do, is much more than I can undertake. So I decided to have printed this thank you message. After almost 1 year of illness, I have just finished my best recovery week since my 50th anniversary, and my date's wrong there. Just a second. That should say 80th anniversary. He's referring to his birthday. He's not referring to his wedding anniversary. So that should say, since my 80th anniversary, referring to his birthday. So since he turned 80, in other words. The Lord has given me grace and strength to preach every Sunday morning and every Wednesday evening, and to broadcast His glorious grace gospel each and every Sunday night at 10:05 over station WLS. I have also been able to carry on my duties as president of the official boards of Milwaukee Bible College and Worldwide Grace Testimony, and to spend hours in Bible study. So here, the picture that I gather from that is this. He has his 55th wedding anniversary, July 11, 1956. 3 days later, on the 14th, he becomes suddenly, violently ill. He's rushed to the hospital, and he spends the rest of 56 and the majority of 57 recuperating. When he turns 80, his birthday is December 31st. So he turns 80 on December 31st, 1956. And so for the first half of 57 then, he's at least able to preach. But he is not able to answer any email. Of course he's not answering email. He's not able to answer any mail or personal correspondence because he just can't handle it. Which I then infer would make it impossible probably for him to do any serious writing. If he can't answer letters and personal correspondence, I don't see him as being able to do personal writing. Mike?
What was wrong with him, do you know?
Liver cancer.
Ooh.
He ultimately dies of liver cancer.
Oh.
Okay. So he has surgery, but he never fully recovers. Okay, so this thank you letter is, again, this is from July 57, and he's explaining why he hasn't been able to, you know, maintain his normal schedule in terms of, you know, answering letters and so on and so forth. Okay, so let me just bring home this point. The Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptist is clearly dated, it says this year, 1956. We know from this letter that he got deathly ill halfway through 1956. Okay? And that he spent an entire year recovering, and even when he writes this in July 1957, a year later, after he got sick, he says that he is still not fully well. Recovered. The title that he says he sent to the press at the end of Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptist, there is no record of it ever having been published. So based on that information, it seems reasonable to assume that this was the last booklet that he wrote. Okay? Now, does everybody understand how I'm coming by that conclusion? Norm?
I know this sounds strange, but what do you think his answer would have been to the... That's a long title. By saying that, I mean, what ordinances today aren't we really under?
I'm sure he would have said, I know he would have said the Lord's Supper.
Not many, so.
Right. But, yeah, as far as I know, there's no record that that booklet was ever put out. Okay?
Do you know who the publisher was?
He doesn't say.
He sent to the publisher.
He doesn't say. Okay, so any questions about that? So, next point. 1957, November 14. Pastor Stamm appears at a panel discussion on dispensationalism at Wheaton College with Dr. M.C. Tenney, Dr. B. Mickelson, Dr. A. Holmes, and Dr. John R. Rice. Now, I have a note here. No new objections or lines of argumentation or other lines of argumentation other than what we have seen in other conflicts emerge from this panel discussion. But this is the contents of that discussion right here. Okay? This panel discussion was held at Wheaton College. This transcript was put out later on by the Brain Bible Society. And you can see that it's dated here, November 14, 1957. Stamm is invited to participate in this panel discussion at Wheaton College on dispensationalism. There's nothing really in the transcript here that is new information in terms of the different debates and discussions that were being had by different dispensationalists. Okay? Nothing at least that I thought was significant or substantial enough to speak on it at any length, other than for you to know that he participated in that panel discussion. One sidelight on that, I spoke to Dr. DeWitt was a student at Wheaton College in 1957, and he was not able to attend that panel discussion because he himself was ill and in the campus hospital, he said, with some sickness, and he remembers it very distinctly, that debate or that discussion was scheduled, and he wanted to go but could not because he was ill and wasn't able to attend. Moving on, also, 1957, December, Stamm addresses a letter to A.W. Tozer regarding an article published in the December 1957 issue of Christian Life magazine titled How to Be Filled with the Spirit. In his letter, Stamm takes exception to Tozer's position that being filled with the Spirit is a second work of grace that will transform the life of the believer. So you start to see the Pentecostal arguments beginning to take shape as some of the Pentecostal authors begin to press some of their issues. Then, 1958, a month later, January 14, 1958, O'Hare dies at his home in Wheaton, Illinois, at the age of 81. When O'Hare died, he had the second longest running radio program in history, eclipsed only by Amos and Andy. So when O'Hare dies, his program was on longer than any other program with the exception of Amos and Andy. January 17, 1958, O'Hare's funeral was conducted at North Shore Church and presided over by Charles F. Baker and C.R. Stamm. The church was packed not only by those who had been blessed by his ministry, but also those who had bitterly opposed his Pauline dispensationalism. And that's coming from Conklin's article, also from Truth Magazine, from, I believe, 1988. So, I have an audio recording of that funeral. I'm trying to figure out a way to upload that to the internet so that anybody can listen to it. But the two that presided at O'Hare's funeral were Baker and Stamm, which I would think fittingly so, given the history that these men have together in contending for Pauline truth. So, O'Hare's real productive period ends in July 1956. Because he falls ill, O'Hare becomes ill in July 1956. In July 1957, he writes the thank you letter explaining his illness. And by January the following year, O'Hare dies. So anything really, beginning really in July 56 until the end of his life in January 58, his productivity in terms of writing, in terms of ministry, is just completely, it's not completely non-existent because he says he was still able to preach, but it goes through a significant decline due to his health. Okay? So it's pretty reasonable. I think it's reasonable to assume that book, The Paulites and the Thessalonian Baptists, was his last one. Yeah.
What it took that people attending his funeral were also those who opposed him. Was that a respect thing, or out of respect for what all he had accomplished, even though they didn't agree?
I think that's definitely a respect thing. Even though they didn't agree with his dispensationalism, this guy was one of the great champions of fundamentalism in the first half of the century. I mean, he just flat out was. All the books that he printed, all of the radio broadcasts, I mean, O'Hare was a nationally known figure. So, and you would expect, hopefully, to see something like that occur, you know, when he passed away. So definitely, I think it's out of respect. Also that same year, 1958, Stamm published Acts Dispensationally Considered, Volume 3. Now this next point I'm going to break out more on here in a minute. 1956 through 1958, Stamm publishes articles in the Searchlight responding to the news that the Scofield Reference Bible was set to be revised under the leadership of Dr. E. Schuller English. For details, please see pages 290 to 312 of The Controversy. We'll say more about that in a minute. So, any questions about the general events here of the 50s?
Well,
Yeah.
It's interesting, those of us that come out of the IFCA, these names at Wheaton College and Ray Stedman read like a who's who. We use Dr. Kenny's textbook at Grisboom. Dr. Mickelson's textbook on interpretation is still in print, and Dr. Holmes is a philosopher of some sort. Of course, everybody knows John R. Rice. But Ray Stedman was Savin or Schaefer. He graduated from Dallas Seminary, and so it's kind of ironic that he's one of the first to come out and speak out against Ray's movement.
Yeah, his review of Stam's book was not very positive. The things that differ. Yeah, appreciate the point. So I want to go to the second point, O'Hare's dispensational development. Throughout the course of these studies, we have been chronicling the development of O'Hare's dispensational teaching. Thus far, we have demonstrated the following stages in O'Hare's theological development. The Acts 2 stage. From the Indy Insight of 1920 till early 1933, when he began to criticize Plymouth Brethren dispensationalism in Bullingerism, Pentecostalism, and the Plymouth Brethren. So he is, remember we talk about this, he is has a position of no water baptism while he is still teaching that the church began in Acts 2 for about 13 years. He's teaching that. Okay? Then we enter into the second time period that we identified, what I call the towards Acts 28 stage. For sure, from the spring of 1935, possibly earlier, O'Hare entertains the Acts 28 position for a time. This can be seen in Wrongly Deriding Christian Brethren from 1935 and the early issues of Bible Study for Bereans from August 1935 through December 1935. Then the third stage we call the anti-Acts 28 stage. That began in January 1936, issue of Bible Study for Bereans. O'Hare comes out hard against the Acts 28 position, claiming that he has seriously entertained it, but ultimately rejected it. So between January 36 and July 36, O'Hare publishes a series of articles in Bible Study for Bereans explaining why he is neither Acts 2 nor Acts 28. And the fourth stage we identified was the toward mid-Acts stage, and we identified that as beginning roughly in August 1936, lasting until the final issue of Bible Study for Bereans in July 1937. O'Hare struggles to articulate exactly where the church began, although he is sure that it did not begin in Acts 2 or in Acts 28. So that's my summary of why we identified those stages. The fifth stage, before Paul wrote Romans stage. Between the close of Bible Study for Bereans in July 1937 and the publication of the dispensational Razzle Dazzle in April 1938, O'Hare published God's Reign of Grace for the Human Race, in which he teaches that the church began before Paul wrote Romans. We have previously identified that this is the earliest clear articulation of the mid-Acts position. This position can be found in the doctrinal statements of both the Worldwide Grace Testimony and the Grace Gospel Fellowship at the time of their founding. When the Worldwide Grace Testimony was founded in 1939 and a few years later the Grace Gospel Fellowship, their statement in those documents about when the church began was right where O'Hare said it there before Paul wrote Romans. Okay? Then, the sixth stage, before Paul wrote his first epistle stage. This view is expressed by O'Hare in The Accuser of the Brethren, which dates from 1945. Quote, I believe that this age of grace and the body of this dispensation began before Paul wrote his first epistle, and that it is absurd to call the church at Corinth or at Philippi or at Ephesus or at Thessalonica a, quote, kingdom church. I have stood against such fantastic teaching as uncompromisingly and aggressively. This, of course, would move the origin of the church closer to the middle portion of the book of Acts, before Paul wrote 1 Thessalonians, which in parenthesis O'Hare viewed to be Paul's first epistle, rather than before Paul wrote Romans in Acts 20. So you see, This is a review of where we've seen him go. Okay? So at the bottom of page 4. I have often heard men such as Richard Jordan say that O'Hare believed in the Acts 13 origin of the church before his death. Documenting this has proven, though, to be more of a challenge. There is some evidence that before his death in 1958, O'Hare embraced and taught the Acts 13 version of the mid-Acts dispensational position. So this is a thing that is sort of commonly repeated audibly, but finding documentation has proved to be more challenging. Now, that's not necessarily because... The biggest reason for that is there's still a bunch of pamphlets out there that we have not been able to date and that we've not been able to process through completely. So it's not as though it might not be out there waiting to be discovered, but that as of right now, it's proven to be more difficult than we would have hoped to be able to do that. Is everybody following what I'm saying? Okay. So what evidence is there then that he did adopt a 13 view before the end of his life? Well, in Dispensational Bible Study, that's this booklet right here, written in 1951, clearly dates from 1951, O'Hare states the following about when God opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. Quote, "It was after Paul said to Israel, 'Lo, we turn to the Gentiles,' Acts 13:46, that God opened the door of faith unto the nations. We should not have that door open before God opened it. Peter's keys of the kingdom and of his gospel of the circumcision and his message of Acts 2:38 have no place in the dispensation or deposit which Christ by revelation gave to Paul." So that it seems like he's saying there that the door to the Gentiles is opened in Acts 13 in those statements. Okay. Moving on, the unsparing grace, God of all grace, written in February 1953, according to the last page of the book, contains language that indicates O'Hare was still holding the position that he outlined in Accuser of the Brethren, 1945. In this book, he says, in light of Acts 10:28, 5:29-32, 11:19, it is absurd to teach that God began on the day of Pentecost the work of baptizing Jews and Gentiles in the joint body of Ephesians 3:6. But in light of Acts 14:27 and 1 Thessalonians 2:14-16, it is obvious that the body of Christ began historically before Paul wrote his first epistle, 1 Thessalonians. So, the previous statement we read is from a book he wrote in 51, which seems to be saying that the door is open and it begins in Acts 13. But then 2 years later, he writes a statement that seems to be hearkening back to what he had said in 1945 when he wrote the Accuser of the Brethren, that the church began before Paul wrote his first epistle. Now, don't misunderstand, though. Even if he says that, does that exclude necessarily him thinking that it happened in Acts 13? No. Because Acts 13 happens before he writes his first what? Epistle. But what we're lacking here is the type of clear statement where he says what? This is where I believe the church began. Okay? Everybody with that? Which would be 1955, which is a typo that should say 2 years later. 2 years later, 1955, with the publication of the all-sufficient, much more overabounding grace of the God of all grace. Seems that as O'Hare aged, he got more wordy in the titles of his books. O'Hare again makes comments that indicate that the body of Christ began in Acts 13. He says the following in different places. As we think of Romans 5:20, studied with Ephesians 3:1-3, very special grace for Gentiles. Let us prayerfully and carefully consider some other scriptures describing the terrible sinful state of the Gentiles from the time Paul said in Acts 13:46, "Lo, we turn to the Gentiles," until he wrote in his farewell message concerning God's eternal grace purpose, and then added, "Whereunto I am ordained a preacher and an apostle and a teacher of the Gentiles," 2 Timothy 1. So, again, he seems to be saying that what he's talking about at the end of his ministry that started in the beginning started in Acts 13:46. Although he still does not flat out say what? I believe this is where the church started. The second quote, we should note with real interest and enthusiasm the statements in Romans 11:30, 11:12, and 11:15. The truth that the Gentiles obtained special divine mercy because of Israel's unbelief, the truth that because of the diminishing and fall of Israel, God's special riches were presented to Gentiles, when and because Israel was cast away, God sent the ministry and message of reconciliation to the Gentiles. After the Apostle Paul said in Acts 13:46, seeing that you, Israel, put the word of God from you and judge yourself unworthy of everlasting life, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. And after he said to Israel in Acts 18:5 and 6, your blood be upon your own heads, I am clean, henceforth I will go to the Gentiles, and the terrible judgment of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16 pronounced upon Israel, God ushered in a new dispensation and gradually changed his spiritual program. So again, if we're looking for the clear statement, it's eluding us. Okay? So the top of page 6. Further complicating matters is the existence of an unnamed and unmarked booklet that has often been attributed to O'Hare, titled A Guide to Dispensational Bible Study. That's this one right here. Okay? His name is not on it. It is unmarked. We don't know who the author is, but it has been attributed. This booklet shows up in multiple O'Hare collections of booklets that people have had. Okay? So let me finish the point. The booklet does follow many of O'Hare's conventions in terms of formatting and capitalization. Let me show you what I mean. O'Hare has a practice that when he wants to emphasize something in the text, he types it in all caps. So there are certain conventions that this booklet follows that seem to indicate that O'Hare may have written it. So back to the point. The booklet does follow many of O'Hare's conventions in terms of formatting and capitalization. This booklet explicitly states that the dispensation of grace began in the 13th chapter of the book of Acts. So let me read you that quote there. Quote, a new government by God, grace began in Acts 13 with the blinding of the Jew, with the blinding of a Jew, and salvation coming to the Gentiles through that blindness. Though this dispensation was a secret from the foundation of the world, yet God planned it for just this time. Whom did God use to perform this dispensational change? Paul, formerly called Saul. See Romans 11:13. Paul in Acts 13 becomes God's apostle to the Gentiles. And then he quotes from Galatians 2. Peter had the gospel of the circumcision to the circumcision. Paul in Acts 13 was appointed as the apostle of the uncircumcision with the gospel of the uncircumcision. Here begins a new apostle with a new message to a new people to form a new body, the church which is the body of Christ. This is God's church of this dispensation to be completed when Christ suddenly appears to transfer all the body members to their heavenly home. That is the type of clear statement that we're looking for. But the problem is, O'Hare's name's not on the booklet. So we can't say for sure or definitely if that's what he said or not. This is not dated. This has nothing on it. All it says on the back is for additional information, free literature or correspondence, write, and it doesn't say anything. It doesn't tell you who to write to, where to go. Just so you know, Mike has the same copy or copy of this, and his is exactly identical to this one. There's no name on it. There's nothing on it at all that would indicate anything about who wrote it specifically.
Is that an original?
This one here?
Yes.
It is possible that it is not an original.
The reason I ask is, you know, he's sort of a really basic form of a lot of his covers.
Your points are well taken, Norm. So again, the formatting and the conventions say that O'Hare probably did write it. If this is a reprint, his name is not on it. It is included in a great many collections of O'Hare materials, but it does not show up on the O'Hare Online Library with the Berean Bible Society. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that he didn't write it either. But it's very clearly arguing that the church started in Acts 13. The problem is we can't say for sure definitely whether or not O'Hare actually wrote it or not. Yeah.
If someone would have found that, I don't know, maybe in his papers after he had died, and they wanted to reprint it because they thought it was important, that they were, well, they would have had to go on to his wife or whoever's taking care of reprinting his book at that time to get permission to reprint it. So was it possible that someone reprinted it without his name so they wouldn't face that issue?
I would say that any scenario could potentially be possible. Okay? I'm not saying that I think Pastor Jordan and other men are wrong, that he wasn't Acts 13 by the end of his life. What I'm saying is hard documentation in the writings of O'Hare of the type of specificity that last quote contains as to now has eluded me. Okay? And whether or not that was written by O'Hare, I can't say for certain. Ronnie?
What's that book read about? It couldn't possibly be that one with a long title about how many of the
150
commandments. No.
This is just about basic dispensationalism, seven dispensations, when did the dispensation of grace begin? Real basic dispensational study. Mike?
I appreciate your being cautious about dating that because I just assumed that it was O'Hare, but you're right. There's no date, there's no name on it. The only thing that It's clearly not printed, but the same type of printing materials that he used at his, wherever he sent his things to. And it seems to be more polished and less wordy than most of his writings. No
yeah.
Rambling, it's very succinct, it's very well written. So I wonder if maybe if it was edited during when he was sick or something and published But the book clearly states that it holds an Acts 13
yeah.
position.
So I agree with you. I just think that we just have to be careful not to say more than what we can realistically claim. So to finish that, at this point, conclusive written documentation that O'Hare ever embraced the Acts 13 version of the mid-Acts position eludes us. It seems likely that he did, just not conclusive. Okay? That's kind of where I'm going to leave that. I'm going to move right on into this last point so we can make sure that we hopefully try to get it covered before we conclude because I think it's important. The last thing I want to talk to you about in the 1950s is this dispute that Stamm has with Dr. English over the revision of the Scofield Reference Bible. Okay? So in the chronology above, we noted that in March 1955, Stamm's Things That Differ was reviewed by Ray Steadman of Palo Alto, California, and R. Hope, the former periodical of Arnold C. Gabelein. By the mid-1950s, editorship of R. Hope had been transferred to Dr. English. Consequently, in the mid-1950s, that a committee was being formed under the headship of Dr. English to revise the Scofield Reference Bible, Stamm objected strongly and wrote a series of articles about the matter in the Searchlight and later republished them as part of the controversy. The articles to which we refer appear in the October 1955 and April 1958 editions of the Searchlight. According to Stamm, he sent copies of Fundamentals of Dispensationalism and Volume 1 of Acts Dispensationally Considered to Dr. English and the entire revision committee, along with a letter that stated in part, quote, "It is our conviction that the so-called grace movement is the spiritual heir of the Schofield Darby, of the Schofield Reference Bible, and that this movement is everywhere spoken against only because our spiritual leaders have condemned it without giving its claims serious consideration. We have wondered whether the revision will remain truly representative of what Dr. Schofield taught, and if not, whether it will still bear his name. If there is to be any change from his view, we pray God it will be represent progress in the recovery of truth rather than a retreat from truth already recovered. With this in mind, we send herewith two volumes which represent the basic views of a growing number of sincere believers who claim to have the answer to the confusion which grips the church at present, especially with regard to the signs of baptism and of the so-called Great Commission." Now understand what's going on here. Dr. English is the new editor-in-chief of Our Hope, who publishes this less-than-flattering review of Stamm's book. Things that differ. When Stamm finds out that this man, English, has been put in charge of the revision committee, he immediately starts to write him and trying to press him to considering not... Stamm obviously perceives that when they revise the Schofield Reference Bible that they are going to be taking what he perceives to be a step what? Backwards. Okay? It is clear from the quotation above that Stamm viewed himself and the Grace Movement as the rightful heirs to the teaching of the Schofield Reference Bible. Stamm viewed his dispensational position and that of the Grace Movement as an outgrowth of the Schofield Reference Bible is beyond doubt. The fact that he thought this is without question. Listen to what he says. The sad fact is, however, that the church as such has ceased going forward in the truth. Many have felt that the Darby Schofield movement brought us to the zenith of truth, and that to depart from what these men have taught is to be guilty of heresy. But those who do not go forward in truth go inexorably backward, so that many who once felt they had reached the summit of dispensational truth have now fallen back into amillenarianism and Pentecostalism, and others who still hold generally to Schofield's position are beginning to ask whether after all we might not have gone through the prophesied tribulation or at least part of it. And then later on that same he says, "It is well more than a year now since we began our efforts to induce the members of the Schofield Reference Bible Revision Committee to consider important dispensational truths. One, which are finding ever wider acceptance among Bible-believing Christians. Two, which we claim to be the answer to the confusion that has gripped the fundamental church. And three, which the Schofield Dispensational Movement itself led us up to." So understand, Stamm perceives that the Grace Movement, that O'Hare, that himself, that Baker, that all the men that are associated with this are the next move forward, if you will, in the recovery of truth beyond the Schofield Reference Bible. Okay? Now whether that's accurate or not is a different discussion. That's the way he views it. Okay? He views them as having taken some of the basic dispensational concepts that were in the reference Bible and having moved forward in the recovery beyond what is in the reference Bible. And he's worried that these guys are going to, on the revision committee, are going to so revise the Schofield Reference Bible that they're going to take it a step what? Backward. Which would then have it basically two steps removed from where Stamm is at instead of what? That one step. Now, that's the best way I can think to describe what Stam thinks is going on. In the end, Stam was vindicated in his comments regarding the revision committee when one considers that every note in the Scofield Reference Bible that had been identified as problematic by the Presbyterian Church, which we talked about last week, was altered in the New Scofield Reference Bible of 1967. Consider the following statement by R. Todd Mignum. Tellingly, when normative dispensationalists revised the Scofield Reference Bible, they made adjustments, improvements to each and every one of the notes identified as problematic by covenant theologians in the debates of the 1930s and 40s. Time and future lessons will tell if Stam was ever guilty of failing to move forward in the recovery of Pauline truths. Okay? So, any questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah, Mike.
I have a warm place in my heart for Dr. English. Years ago when I was, I wrote him and asked for one of his commentaries because I couldn't find them in the bookstore. They were out of print. And he sent me one of his letters, a very nice letter. So I had that in my files, and I keep that. He also edited his own reference Bible called the Pilgrim Bible, which was a children's Scofield Bible.
Okay.
I don't know if it's ever...
He's also the primary biographer of Ironside.
That's right.
He wrote a book called Ordained of the Lord, which was a biography of H.A. Ironside's life. English was involved in that as well. So, there you have it. I think the 50s in a nutshell. I do have here a couple photocopies of some articles. If somebody's interested in having these, they can certainly take them and run them over to the copier and run some copies. Here's an article from a Chicago newspaper noting O'Hare's 55th wedding anniversary from Chicago newspaper. Here's an article commemorating his 80th anniversary, or 80th birthday, and they interviewed him for the Chicago paper talking about now that you're 80, basically where do you see your ministry going? So he talks a little bit about that. Understand he's quite still very sick in that one. If you want these, just let me know. This one, these are newspaper stories noting his death in the Chicago newspaper. And then finally, there's an article, and I don't know what year this is from yet. I haven't been able to determine it, but talking about Stam being one of the successors to the pastorship of the North Shore Church after O'Hare died. So this had to have been from, I would guess, the 60s possibly. I don't know exactly. I'm going to have to go back and figure out what years. Stam was the pastor at North Shore for a couple of years. I don't remember exactly when those what those years were. So if you want any of these copies of any of these articles, let me know. Is there any further questions or comments about anything in the notes about O'Hare, Stam, or the 1950s? Yeah?
Why do you think they're so hesitant about stating that Acts 13:46 is the starting point of the church?
Well, first of all, Stam's not hesitant at all. Out from the get-go, he thought it started in Acts 9 with the salvation and conversion of Saul. O'Hare's experience was different. He started here, Acts 2, entertained the other position on the other end, Acts 28. He comes to a conclusion that neither one of those is right. And for a while, he's sort of fumbling around. He's saying this is wrong and this is wrong, but he's not really saying what he thinks the answer is. And then eventually he says it's before Paul writes Romans. Then he says it's before he writes his first epistle. And then, as I said, a lot of them, so he works his way incrementally backward from Acts 28 towards the middle section. And like I said, it's commonly understood that he was Acts 13 before he died, even though I can't find exact documentation of that yet.
I just read the one about Baker and the one about Stam in the Acts books. And I don't think either one of them are very clear. They point those verses out and stuff, but none of them really come out and say it's the same as compared to none of them coming out to say this is the point.
I think, too, that you have to look at that from the standpoint of thought progression. That hopefully, if I come to a fundamental belief about something, say, today, hopefully 5 years ago, 5 years from now, I can explain it better 5 years from now than I did today. And if you read these books, you see that type of refining of the explanation. You see that in O'Hare, you see that in Baker and Stamm, both. That they, you know, as they studied and studied and studied, they get better and better and better as far as being more precise in how they explain things.
It seems like if they would come out and say that this is the point instead of just saying that X, it would be more influential on people that are of the X2 position.
Well, the term mid-axe, first of all, none of these guys would have said I'm mid-axe. They would have said I'm a Pauline dispensationalist. Okay? That's probably what they would have called themselves. When they say that, they mean that the church began with the ministry of who? Paul. Okay? The term mid-axe comes into usage sometime later to describe this group that is believing that it began somewhere in the middle section, of which there are basically two stripes. There's the Acts 9 and then the Acts 13. Both of those are considered to be, quote, mid-Acts. So when you hear people talk about mid-Acts dispensationalism, they're talking basically about somebody that starts the church, the body of Christ, some point towards the middle of the book of Acts, and with something related to the ministry of the Apostle Paul. Some will say it's Acts 9, some will say it's Acts 13. Stamm was always Acts 9. O'Hare's experience, his journey was quite a bit different than Stamm's. But we got to quit. We're 5 minutes past. I appreciate your attention. See you guys next week. We'll move on with talking about, what are we talking about next week? I don't even remember. Anyway, have a good week.
Turn it off.